Well, good evening, everyone. And people in the back, hear me? Okay, Greg? Good. Well, for some reason, as I was doing my bows, I was remembering the Ed Sullivan Show. Maybe most of you are too young to even know what that refers to. It was a delightful entertainment show that I used to watch with my parents. You know, we'd get the TV trays out, have dinner on, and we'd all like sit there and watch. And somehow, giving Dharma talks feels a little bit like I'm Ed Sullivan, kind of about to entertain you in some way. And it's Sunday. Yeah, it's always on Sunday. But I hope you have settled into the schedule a little bit. First day is always a bit bumbly as we find our way together. And maybe you're noticing the kind of residual, probably some tiredness left over from your life, seeming perhaps even stronger than in your life because now you just see it. And certainly it took you a lot of effort to get here. Just to get here sometimes is pretty challenging. But I also hope you're feeling maybe a little bit of ease as we've stepped back from our kind of daily concerns and troubles. I hope so. And if not, I hope it will be soon you feel a little bit of ease. I titled this talk, This is Not a Weekend Workshop. And I think we can appreciate maybe the difference between session, as Norman talked about a little bit earlier today, and a weekend workshop. Because, or maybe I should say maybe in other words, a weekend workshop more or less offers a guarantee of improving something, of fixing something, of getting rid of something. And I'm sorry to say, session comes without any guarantees at all. It's not that I think weekend workshops are without purpose. It's just that session is not about changing or improving ourselves. The word itself, the word session, is a compound of Sino-Japanese two characters, setsu, the first one, and shin. And shin, maybe most of you know, means heart or mind in Chinese. It's interesting, in Chinese-Japanese, the heart-mind, the heart and mind were seen as one, not separate as we do here in the West. And setsu has several meanings, to touch, to receive, to convey. And usually the word session itself is translated into English as something like to touch the heart-mind, to touch our innermost being, right? I think that's quite a beautiful translation. However, a session can also be translated to receive the heart-mind. And personally, I like this translation a little better. Because we often enter a weekend workshop or something like that with some idea of what I'm going to do, what I'm going to accomplish. But if we bring that kind of intention to session, you're going to be in for a really hard time. To touch the heart-mind implies me touching, my action doing this. To receive the heart-mind is, I think, a little less self-centered, a little less focused on me doing something. And Dogen Zenji, Norman mentioned earlier this morning. And Dogen, for those of you who may not know, was the Japanese priest who brought our form of practice from China to Japan way back in the 1200s. So he wrote in the Mountains and Waters Sutra, "Mountains, rivers, earth, the sun, the moon, and stars are heart-mind." So what can you or I possibly do given the vastness of the heart-mind that Dogen talks about, but simply open to receiving? But this is not a kind of sit on the couch and watch TV, passively receiving something. We do make effort in session, but the effort we make is not focused on some goal or some kind of attainment. The effort that we make, as Norman mentioned earlier, is to return kind of again and again to our wholehearted practice, the awareness of our body, the awareness of our breath, letting go of judgment, letting go of criticism, evaluation. And this is the way we enter into spacious receiving. In session, we allow our heart-mind to come forward fully through the medium of this practice. And how do we do this? The next line that Dogen wrote in the Mountains and Rivers Sutra goes like this. At just this moment, what is it that appears directly in front of you? At just this moment, what appears directly in front of you? So we become intimate with the heart-mind in the immediacy of our life. And session is the container carefully designed to help us return over and over again to the present moment, facing, being with what is right in front of us. The sound of the great bell before we bow, the walk that we hear on the wooden hand calling us to the zendo, the chanting before we eat, carefully attending to our jobs, the cleaning of our odoki bowls, and perhaps most of all, the silence that we so carefully nurture. All of these call us back to our body and breath. So when you feel restless, bored, tired, impatient, squirmy, or just vacant, you may recall Dogen's question. At just this moment, what is it that appears directly in front of you? And then look. See what is right there. As Norman mentioned earlier, the title of our Mountains and Rivers Zen Community 2018 practice period is Living in the World of Samsara, Suffering and Resilience. Now, before this practice period started, I wondered if the theme would kind of scare people off. Samsara, suffering. But no, actually, we had, I think, very strong, maybe record attendance all throughout our biweekly meetings. So Kate really hit upon a good and timely topic for this practice period. So I'd like to say just a few words about suffering and resilience in the context of this session, since we've been talking about that all practice period. So our habit, at least for most of us, is to view our suffering and our challenging situations as if something is wrong, that our discomfort is a mistake. And often we view ourselves as a victim, deeply flawed when some kind of misfortune arises in our life. But suffering is not a mistake. It's part of our human condition. And each of us, at times in our lives, wish we could desperately change the end of the story. And each of us, of course, often have experiences of annoyance at minor challenges that arise. And the Buddha called the resulting suffering that comes from that desire for things to be different than they are dukkha, as Norman mentioned earlier today. And dukkha has been, of course, translated as suffering, discontent, hollowness, dissatisfaction, and probably many other ways. The loss of what we like, the arising of what we dislike, the separation from those we love, the failing and aging body, the seeming meaninglessness of life, etc. Dukkha is the place and the time when most of us want to change the channel. And what the Buddha recognized was the profound import of simply accepting the truth of our life as it is, the truth of this world as it is. We all know, of course, the reality of physical pain, mental suffering, unsatisfying and ungovernable experiences that we undergo. At least we all recognize that at some level. But most of us keep turning away, perhaps denying what is before us or seeking some kind of palliative. We resist and seek ways to have control, to remain steady, and possess our lives. This is my life. Get this out of here. Dukkha is born when we fall between the gap of what we think our lives and world should be and what they are. The Buddha summed up how his own monks tended to view their suffering like this. I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Do you ever feel like a victim? A victim of the circumstances of your life? Well, Sesshin is a really interesting time and place to look closely at the dukkha that arises in your life. And we should remember that the first discourse the Buddha gave after his awakening was called Setting the Wheel in Motion, setting in motion the wheel of the Dharma, where he clearly described dukkha as the first noble truth. And he did this to encourage us, I believe, to look closely at our human condition and understand deeply that our lives are really far from the ideal of happiness that we all perhaps envision. And this looking closely at suffering is not morbid. It alerts us to the fact that we are not clearly aware of the nature of human life and the nature of the world. Now, you may have noticed already here in the session that there is a little different tone to suffering and discontent here, this long day that we've been sitting. For one thing, it's harder to escape, right? There's no Netflix, no novels to pick up, no beer, no cell phone. We're stuck here with ourselves, with our discomfort, whatever kind of discomfort arises. And true, we may indulge in fantasy plans, maybe creating detailed lists on how to improve the session. But I've noticed in my own practice that the stuckness will almost inevitably return, which is a good thing. It really is a gift, because our first understanding of where we are stuck is often not quite right. In our haste to dispel our discontent, we don't look closely at it with a sense of tenderness. What is this? What is this right before me? And so rather than seeking a good diagnosis, we just reach for the painkillers in the medicine cabinet, whatever they may be. We blame ourselves, we blame somebody else, or we just maybe try to suck it up and move on. In my life, I've started to take the inner voice that tells me I should, I shouldn't, it should, it shouldn't, as a kind of indication to look a little deeper. So for example, the critical voice that tells me I should lose weight, exercise more, be smarter, study more, practice more, all has the ring of truth, and yet often there's something unseen behind it. The seemingly counterintuitive instruction as we sit in Zazen is simply to be with our discomfort, our emotional pain or frustration, knowledge of our own selfish behavior maybe, to hold whatever arises with compassion. The beginning of resilience is the willingness to be present. Resilience. In the material sciences, resilience is understood as to mean something like the ability of a material to return to its original form after being bent or pushed in some way, compressed or stretched. In terms of life, I think of resilience as that quality of being upright or returning to a kind of centeredness. Every life is buffeted by the ill winds of misfortune, pain, blame, and disrepute, and also by what we usually consider the positive winds of praise, fame, pleasure, and gain. And although we seldom question our responses to those positive winds, both the ill and the positive winds can blow us off course, causing us to lose our equanimity, causing us to lose our mindfulness. Resiliency is that quality that allows us to be with our discomfort, frustration, disappointment, worry, sadness, boredom, and with excitement, praise, joy, fascination. Like a strong tree with deep roots, a tree that has weathered years of storms along with the beautiful days. Resiliency is returning to our integrity. You know, nestled in that word of resilience is the verb to resile. And resile is not recognized by my spell check as I was typing this up. But according to the Oxford Dictionary, it refers to something like abandoning a position or course of action. So by extension, then, resilience means bouncing back. In other words, abandoning a path or course that presumably leads to collapse or suffering or distress in some way. So in Sesshin, we resile from the busyness and distractions and attitudes of our daily life and return to the natural spaciousness and clarity that is also a part of our life. And you know, maybe you've already noticed another kind of resiliency that Sesshin teaches us. Our uprightness is supported by all that is around us. Our gathering here at this place is only possible because of each other. Yes, there are some individuals who kind of stand out, a little more visible in the retreat, like Norman, or Tanto, Kate, the Eno, the Cooks, etc. But their hard work is possible and also supported by each of us, just as we are supported by them. Sesshin is not something we go to experience and leave like a weekend workshop. I think it's far truer to say we become the Sesshin. Sesshin is a teaching of intimacy that we already and inseparably belong to each other. For this is simply the nature of life. So often in our haste and hurry and occasional discouragement, we forget our interdependence. In Sesshin, we affirm and rest in that knowing. And it may not seem so right now, but I suspect as the Sesshin progresses, our interdependence will become clearer. Just like, as you know, at breakfast and lunch we chant, may we, with all living beings, realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And here we may consider the word emptiness as a code word for intimate connection, for oneness. So resiliency is kind of like a muscle. The more we nurture and exercise it, the more available it becomes. In the Zendo, we begin our practice by taking an upright posture. And I don't mean the full lotus posture by any means. I've never been able to do that. But a posture that of intent, a posture of integrity. That alone, just taking a posture of intent and integrity nurtures resilience. Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, wrote in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, in Zazen posture, mind and body have great power to accept things as they are, whether they are agreeable or disagreeable. And I have found that to be very true. I think resiliency in Sesshin is also strengthened when we bring forth the courage to stay in the present moment, whatever that moment presents to us, rather than turning away or distracting ourselves. And courage, for some reason, isn't discussed much in the Buddhist tradition. But it is courage that enables us to ride through the rough waters and not abandon our practice when we end up for a while drifting on dead calm seas. Over and over again, courageously returning to awareness of body and breath. We begin to let go of I, me, and mine. And gradually, or suddenly, we open to a radical shift, a shift from my experience to just a flow of experience. I'm sure over these next few days, you'll be discovering and exploring other ways to strengthen and practice resiliency. But I'd like to end with a little piece of advice. There are two ways to survive a sesshin. One is to concentrate on getting through the sesshin like a boot camp, counting down the days, the hours, planning what you're going to do during the breaks, hitting the snack table after each meal for a sugary reward. And the second way is to focus on each moment as it arises. As Dogen said, at just this moment, what is it that actually appears directly in front of you? And either way will get you through a sesshin. But only in the second do we become ever more intimate with our life. So which will you choose? This practice we do is not complicated, but it's not easy. With our practice and with kindness, we transform our suffering into resilience. And with resilience, we are then of some use to others and the world. Now, I know you're probably eager to go to bed. Enough talk already. So I'd like to send you off to bed with a poem. By the great Zen master, Pablo Neruda. It's one you've probably heard before, called, in English, Keeping Quiet. Now, we will count to 12, and we will all keep still for once on the face of the earth. Let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales. And the man gathering salt would not look at his hurt hands. Those who prepared green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is all about. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of the threat and of threatening ourselves with death. Now, I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go. Thank you. May our intention